You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stage Left, a bi-monthly podcast where we talk about the latest shows on Broadway and beyond. I'm your host, Rob Russo, writer, theater critic, and founder of StageLeft.nyc, and co-host and co-producer of the Fabulous Invalid podcast, also on the Broadway Podcast Network. This podcast provides a platform for younger critics and theater journalists with the goal of broadening the cultural conversation to elevate and include as many diverse perspectives as possible.
I'm dying to know what's across the road, what's behind the wall, what's around the corner, and what will it take till I find my way? Will it be today? Will it be too late? Wait till you see what's next.
Joining me this week is David Gordon, theater critic, senior features reporter, and principal photographer at theatermania.com, and current president of the Outer Critics Circle. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, delighted to have you. And returning for round two is Casey Mink, senior staff writer at Backstage. Welcome back, Casey.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be back.
Yeah, I wish this was the kind of show where I had a couch so I could be like, welcome to the, back to the couch. But
it's okay. Unfortunately, but honestly, speaking of bad angles, a couch never flattering.
Oh, I like couches.
Yeah.
Okay. I just like sitting.
Yeah.
And we're already disagreeing. I love it. Perfect. All right, so this week, for this episode, we're going to take a look at three different plays that are at three of New York's best nonprofit theater companies. So first up, we'll talk about My Name is Lucy Barton, which is playing at Manhattan Theater Club. Then we'll talk about Is This a Room, which just finished a run at the Vineyard Theater off Broadway. And then we'll finish with A Soldier's Play, which is currently at Roundabout Theater Company on Broadway. Excellent. So to kick us off, my name is Lucy Barton. This is a one-woman show adapted by the book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Strout, in which Laura Linney plays Lucy Barton, spoiler alert, a woman who wakes up after an operation to find her estranged mother at the foot of her bed.
And also played by Laura Linney.
Also played by Laura Linney, spoiler alert, number two.
Mother, yeah.
Exactly. And during their days-long visit, Lucy tries to understand her past, works to overcome terms with her family, and begins to find herself as a writer. That's publicist speak right there.
There you go.
From the show description. Alrighty, so what did we think of My Name is Lucy Barton? Who wants to go first?
I'm still asleep.
Yeah.
Oh, what a bore.
The funny thing is, because just, I guess my quote-unquote reputation, everyone thinks that any play written by a woman, I'm just going to fucking love it.
Right.
And so I have to sometimes just let people down very easy where I'm like, hey, I don't actually love everything just because it's by and about women. It also has to be compelling and interesting storytelling as well, which I'm not saying this isn't in. It's none of that,
right.
But I don't know if it was enough.
Right.
I don't think it's a play.
Well, that's an interesting question, right? I mean, so it's adapted from this book, which I have to admit I didn't read.
I read the book because I did the press junket for it.
Okay.
And Rona was there and Elizabeth Strout was there and Laura. Yeah. And I'd read the book.
Yeah.
Because it's very short. It's very...
Right. That's what I've heard. It's
a quick read. 120, 130 pages. It's nothing.
A novella, if you will.
Yeah.
Right, right. That's the length of a play.
Right,
right. Yeah.
And this, to me, was just like sitting in a theater listening to, you know, an audiobook lull me to sleep, which is fine.
Is it?
Yeah, I don't know.
An audiobook lulling me to sleep is fine.
Right, right.
Not in a theater prices that people pay. And it's one of the best-selling shows in Manhattan Theater Club history.
Yes, it's unbelievable.
I mean, I will say thank goddess for Laura Linney, because
in
less competent hands, I mean, that play wouldn't even be... I will say that I think it's worth seeing only because she really tries her damnedest,
It's worth seeing specifically because you're watching an actor really try to sell material.
Right.
And she does so... So well.
Right. I mean, I was just completely rapt by her performance. And it's amazing because the character itself is not particularly memorable or impressionable. And that's almost kind of the point, right? That she's sort of this like average woman who's had this awful traumatic, you know, upbringing and is coming to terms with it now. She's just like sort of plain Jane from the Midwest.
Yeah.
And yet, Laura Linney was
just
absolutely compelling. I mean, I don't know if this was true at the performance that you guys were at. Maybe it was like her allergies. I don't know. But she kept like gently wiping away tears throughout the 90 minutes of her performance. And it felt like this like really poignant, vulnerable, you know, performance. So I don't know, again, if that was just, you know,
I mean,
were that day or if it's
always
like
that.
Yeah, I think
they got really lucky that Laura Linney agreed to do it and carry it on her back.
Yes.
I mean, I feel like it's comparable in some ways, even though it wasn't a one-person play, to The Sound Inside, which so heavily relied on Mary Louise Parker.
Yeah. Yes.
But the difference is that was an incredible actor rising to meet incredible material. In my opinion, I loved that play.
I loved that play.
This was the unfortunate other side of that coin, which is an incredible actor is single-handedly elevating material herself. Right. And that's just, I don't know, Laura Linney could be put to so much better use.
Yes, I agree with that.
100%. I might even be the detractor that says I love Laura Linney in theory. Like, I love Laura Linney.
Wow.
I know.
Lines are being drawn.
Yeah.
I love watching her on stage, but there's something about her that I always find very cold.
Mm.
And I thought that really didn't help this production.
Yeah. Well, again, because
it helped with the role in The Mother. When she was playing The Mother, I thought that worked.
I can see that. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I walked out and just texted a friend who had seen it a few days prior and was like, okay, so she just wanted to sleep with her doctor, right? That's kind of my big
takeaway. That's Casey's takeaway.
Well,
yeah.
Also, I had seen it the same, and unfortunately we're not talking about this play, but I saw it the same week that I saw Grand Horizons.
Yes.
And a much better play.
A much better play also about
female sexuality.
Well, and dealing parental, parent-child relations.
Yes.
And I was just like, damn, rough week for anyone who had contentious issues with their parents, so every single person on earth.
Yeah.
But that play is much better, but we're not talking about it.
No, I agree. I mean, David, you touched on something earlier, which to me is like the key takeaway, and it's what I wrote about mostly in my review, is anytime you're adapting something for the stage, I feel like you need to have a reason why you've chosen to adapt it. Why can't it just live on its own terms? Mm-hmm. And this, to me, I mean, the biggest tell of this entire production is the fact that Penguin Random House Audio is recording it as like a live, you know, taping of a show, which is just like an audiobook.
Well, which I find really interesting that Penguin is doing it, not Audible.
Well, right, that's the thing. Audible does this at the Minetta Lane Theater downtown, and they do it, I think, incredibly well most of the time. I mean, they presented that Carey Mulligan play, Girls and Boys.
Yes.
One of those.
Yeah. Which I did not like.
Okay.
Oh,
well,
I loved it.
Really? Oh my gosh. Okay. I did not.
I'll watch her do anything.
I think about that play all the time, and it was very impactful in the room, and I think there were moments that were synesthetic and they worked with all of the visual and the audio and everything, but it also does work as an audio play. But this, you're totally right, it just could be an audio play and you don't get anything additional from having seen it as well.
I think they went into it specifically saying, we are going to do this as a vehicle for Laura Linney. That's just what I've gathered from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's never a
certainly
great
that way.
Start.
Yeah. And I think they specifically wanted to keep it in this format. Why, I don't know. But everybody I know that has seen My Name is Lucy Barton has walked out and said, why just one other actor? Just put another actor in.
Right.
Make it a play.
Right. I mean, cast an amazing actor like Holland Taylor as her mother.
Kathleen Chalfant. We're
going.
Seriously, yeah. Well, that's the thing about a one-person play that can be so incredible. I don't know if either of you saw, speaking of Audible, Harry Clark.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I mean, Billy Crudup played like 8 different characters?
And
he summoned each one.
No, I think more.
One,
I think it was 25 or something.
Yes, it was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And he summoned each one so specifically. And also that show, unlike this one, was basically him on an empty set. And everything that you saw was in your head. And what drove me crazy about the design of this production, it's Bob Crowley, right? Who's like one of the greatest designers, you know, to work on Broadway and theater in general. And literally she would be like, and then we were in the cornfields. And then a cornfield would appear in the background. And it's like, I don't need to see a picture of a cornfield.
Right.
Just talk about a cornfield and I can be complicit in the theater making.
There were
that's
a lot of
here.
Bizarre directorial design choices.
Yeah.
It reminded me of when they did Heisenberg, which Mary Louise Parker, we're just going to talk about Mary Louise Parker.
Fine.
This is a Mary Louise Parker show.
When they did Heisenberg at City Center, and it was in the tiny space. Mm. It was in the really tiny space. Mm-hmm. It's a two-character
stage two.
And they had the actors on all sides.
Right.
And then they moved it to Broadway, and they had the actors, they had the audience on all sides again.
On stage,
On stage. And for this one, they had audience on stage also, but they brought the set out a little bit and changed the seating configuration in the front orchestra by making it a thrust, but ever so slightly. And so it just struck me as they were trying to get into, to create intimacy in a way that just felt really artificial and just made it worse for me because I spent the I spent that entire show looking at people dozing off on stage.
Oh, a girl legit fell asleep in the front row on stage.
Which is very unfortunate for Laura Linney.
Yeah. To have that energy being fed to you.
And
on
very
stage.
Distracting for me because I kept saying to myself, God, I wish I'm glad I'm not there, but God, I wish I could also doze right
now. It's hollow. It's exactly what you're saying. It's like these really hollow gestures of intimacy where it's trying to say, look how intimate we are.
Yeah. Mm.
And actually on stage seating for that play is entirely, it's ill-fitting. It doesn't work at all.
And she doesn't play to them very much
at all.
Either.
No, she doesn't. Honestly, I've never thought of her as being a cold actor, but she was cold in this. You're right. Damn.
Some revelations happening on stage.
I
mean,
sorry, I don't want to change your opinion of Laura Linney because I love Laura Linney too.
We all love Laura Linney. I mean,
yeah.
We're not
she's one of the greatest actors of her generation, say so. Right?
I definitely think so. I also certainly think she's probably very likely to get a Tony nomination for this.
If not win.
Okay,
we'll take it easy. I think Mary Louise Parker, just one more thing about Mary Louise Parker.
I'm worried that Mary Louise Parker is going to cancel herself
out. She's going to be double nominated.
Oh, that's right.
But that's a conversation for 4 months from now.
Yeah. You'll have to come back.
Tony's episode.
Yeah, I know. It's the second time you put in the plug for the Tony's episode.
Yeah,
Casey, you're invited.
You guys hear that? It's binding if you say it on the podcast.
It's happening.
I also just want to bring up, and this is something that I've made fun of to friends at work everywhere. That play is staged. My Name Is Lucy Barton is staged in such a way where she's sitting on the bed and she's one character and then she turns her back.
Yeah.
It's staged like a 30 Rock one person.
Yeah.
Show, where it's like, I'm going to stand to my right and I'm going to be one character. Then I'm going to stand to my left and be another character.
And then is that one moment where she says, and my name is Lucy Barton. And everyone's just like,
she did the thing.
She did the thing.
It was the lead of my review. It's like that moment you dread where the titular line is said aloud, you know? And I literally, she said it, and in my mind I said, nobody asked. Literally, is that supposed to be some revelation, what your name is? It's all my ticket stuff.
This truly has been a soldier's play.
Right. It was, the real Marilyn was in front of us all along, on Smash.
He died the death of a salesman.
Maybe, I don't know what about this all made it not work, but the direction, I think, really sealed the deal as far as it being just really forgettable.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's forget it.
But it's selling like hotcakes.
That's true. And it's interesting because there's a crossover of Laura Linney fans and fans of the book.
Yeah.
And it's like a really sweet nexus.
There are a lot of book clubs going to see that
tickets
show.
Are
and it's like
very hard to get for
it would
show.
Be so cool if a book that need or that called for being seen in a different medium were adapted and they didn't follow this model of like a bestseller, we're just going to put it up exactly the same.
Yes.
Let's do something that deserves another dimension.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing feels a little too contrived and commercially driven. Okay, so let's move on now to our second play of the episode. We're going to talk about Is This a Room? Which, like I said at the top, just completed a return engagement at the Vineyard Theater downtown. In this piece of documentary theater constructed verbatim from the FBI transcript of the June 3rd, 2017 interrogation of 25-year-old former Air Force linguist Reality Winner, which seems like a fake name, but it is in fact the character's name and the person's name. In the show, the audience witnesses the interview and charging of Winner with leaking top secret evidence of Russian interference in the 2016 election. It's a real life story that is still unfolding because Winner is still in prison, serving a 5-year sentence for violating the Espionage Act. So this was a really, really interesting piece of documentary theater.
I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with it. Absolutely obsessed with it. It was like at the end of last year, all I was telling people to do was go see Is This a Room and go see Our Dear Dead Drug Lord. Both gone now.
They are both gone now, unfortunately. But that's why I wanted to talk about this piece because I feel like it was a bit of a toast of the town last fall.
Slow burn.
Slow burn. Sure.
And then all of a sudden, towards the end of the run, everyone was freaking out about it so much so that it came back.
And it's very polarizing.
Yeah.
You either really love it or you really don't,
thoughts that we're going to get into.
Because
I don't love it as much as I suspect the two of you did.
Ugh.
Well, first of all, I mean, I love documentary theater and I'm like here for any time someone wants to take a verbatim anything. And
I've been seeing a lot of documentary theater this month, actually.
Yeah.
What else?
Did you see The Courtroom?
No, I haven't seen The Courtroom yet, but you know, from Fires in the Mirror back in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then I saw How to Load a Musket.
Oh, yes.
Talene Monahan's play about war reenactors, which was really interesting.
Yeah.
And then I saw something at the Art New York theaters last night called Border People, which is like Fires in the Mirror, and it's one guy playing 11 different characters. Immigrants, people in the South Bronx, African-American, Latino, Muslim.
Cool.
And it's just stories of borders, and not just like physical borders, but racial, cultural, religious. And I don't know if it's just something in the ether that all of these shows are starting to pop up, or if documentary theater is making a resurgence, but I feel like, is this a room? Is it the forefront of a movement that's beginning?
Mm-hmm. Well, in an age when like we're like questioning truth and fact, 100%. I mean, perhaps there is this desire, this yearning to like get to the root of things and put live, real stories on stage verbatim.
And it's funny because it's diametrically opposed to sort of the escapism, which is also something that we're all craving a little bit more right now in these these times, we'll call them that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So first of all, I loved Emily Davis's performance.
She
was unbelievable.
I think it's one of the most incredible performances I've ever seen in my life. Yes. I've never seen a performance like that in all my years.
It's
of
so
trite
to say, but it felt like one of those performances where you're like, she wasn't acting, like she was living.
Well, it's so unassuming.
But, yes.
The naturalism of all these, I mean, obviously in documentary theater, you hope that naturalism is just sort of implicit, but oftentimes, I have seen it, the actors aren't, it's tough. It's a really tough thing to do, but her performance as reality winner, it's haunted me. I saw it in December, and I have not stopped thinking about it. It's just, it is so, it's like just a roller coaster ticking very slowly, and all of a sudden, it just, the bottom falls out, and you're, I don't know. Give her trophies.
It goes from 0 to 100 really quickly.
Yeah.
Like in a way that you don't even realize. It's like, oh shit, it just, something just happened.
Yeah. So the thing I do have an issue with this show though.
Okay.
Is I feel like it would benefit from more of a frame. Which is to say that you arrive at the theater, you sit down, you witness this interaction between the FBI and this woman. You don't necessarily know, unless you bring to the theater your own knowledge of the story.
Because it just stops. It just ends.
Because the story hasn't ended.
Right.
She's still in prison.
She's
like, you know, it's still unfolding before our eyes.
But it's also nothing other than the transcript. So it goes where the transcript goes, and then the transcript ends.
There are some really sort of jarring moments where there are omitted sections from the transcript that they have a really cool way of, speaking of great direction, they have a really cool way of letting us know that they're
That were redacted.
Yeah, we don't know.
From the transcript. But that's part of it, too, because, you know, I read in the intro that it's, you know, that she leaked this document referring to Russian interference in the 2016 election. I don't believe that's ever said in the play. I don't recall hearing it. I believe the substance of the intelligence was, in fact, one of the redacted moments, unless I'm misremembering.
I think you're right. Casey seems a lot more of a diehard than I am on this.
Well, I only saw it the one time because I was late to it.
So again, I mean, what I think this play is trying to do, and very nobly so, is be a part of a very important and urgent conversation about how we interact with our government and how secrets and information are processed and shared or not. But the problem is that I have with the play is that, like, I don't think it's doing that necessarily because it doesn't have any sort of larger frame and all the details are redacted from the story. So if you walked in not knowing anything and you didn't read anything else after, you'd be like, oh, okay, this woman took some documents and got arrested and that's it. When the story itself is far more complicated than that.
Well, and to some degree, it's a similar question to My Name is Lucy Barton and the Is This a Play?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it was incredibly
much more compelling than Lucy Barton.
Oh, certainly.
But I think any sort of like you know, police interrogation or the FBI or whatever is going to be, you know, it isn't more inherently dramatic because there are characters interacting with each other, not just one person flipping side to side, pretending to be two other people.
I mean, I do think that this is a play. I think that Tina Satter, did we say her name?
Yes, Tina Satter.
Tina Satter, director, creator.
Yeah.
Half straddle.
Right. There is no credited writer of this play, which is, you know, it's super notable. But I I agree that there is no frame, but I definitely don't think there is not structure. I think there is absolutely a structure in place, and directorial choices have been made to contribute to this very, very eerie sort of haunting piece of theater.
It's very well crafted. My just concern is that it seems untethered from any sort of larger conversation about the morality or the ethics or the legality of what actually occurs in the show itself.
I kind of wish it was one of those plays where it ended and they bowed, and because there is no ending, because life is still happening, no one really knew it was over. And to me, it just sort of felt like maybe to some degree of what you were feeling, I wish there was more. Like, I wish there was a second act.
Right. Or, like, a second act facilitated talk back or something to, like, make it more of a conversation. I know. You say talk back and everyone's eyes just sort of glaze over. Like, no, I don't want to witness a talk back. But, like, I don't know.
I don't want to hear
something.
Old people talking about.
I don't want to hear an old person raise their hand and say, I actually have a comment, not a question.
Right.
It's a play that's clearly calling for a conversation. And I feel like you're not given enough information to intelligently have that conversation unless you do your own research.
Which we should.
Yeah, no, I mean, I certainly did my research.
Don't you think maybe the play is asking us to do that? I mean, I've heard some rumblings that it's going to have another run.
Yes.
And prior to the election.
Mm-hmm.
And with the intent of this needs to be seen before the election, is that not asking your audience to lean forward, do the extra research, figure out what's going on here, be an engaged civilian, and know what's on the line here, what you're voting for, how everything affects everything else.
Right.
And production-wise, you could do it anywhere. It's not really, there's staging, but it's not a huge set. You can do it on folding chairs. You could do it as a reading. You could do it.
Right. You could do it on Broadway.
On Broadway. Right. You should do it on
Broadway. Well, in that way, it reminds me of the courtroom, right? Which has been done in a variety of different settings.
I still need to
across
see that.
The city over the course of the past year. And that is a verbatim transcript of a trial, of an immigration trial. And then Act Two is the appellate version of it. See, right. but there was more of an arc to the story because you get the more complete story. Here, the story is
similar
that she's still
to
in prison,
another play that I love, which I brought up last time I was on the podcast.
Casey, what play would that be?
Have I told you about what the Constitution means to me? No, but actually, just excerpting those Supreme Court cases.
Right.
That, I guess, is sort of to your point. It's used in that play as evidence in a much larger sort of structure.
Right. Right.
And I think that your criticism is a valid one, but I also think that my opinion is the right one.
But also, you're right. No, well, I mean, also, I should put my cards out on the table, full disclosure. You know, I come to this, as a lawyer, because I do go to law school and I am licensed to practice law in New York State. And it's not an ad.
That's good to know.
And I spent 4 years at a national security agency earlier in my career. I was at the State Department for 4 years. And I had a top
How did
secret.
You get into theater?
I know, exactly.
Yeah, right.
We'll talk about that later. But I had a top secret security clearance. And with that comes a lawful obligation to handle material responsibly, right? And there's a question. I mean, to the Vineyard Theater's credit, after you see the show, I bought tickets. So I got the email from them, you know, saying, thanks for coming to the show. And they linked to several articles about this case. And they included one from the Washington Post that said, Reality Winner is not a whistleblower. And it was an opinion piece by a lawyer for whistleblowers who says she's actually not a whistleblower. She's someone who irresponsibly leaked information that she was not entitled to leak.
Right.
And, you know, definitionally, a whistleblower is someone who observes waste, fraud, abuse, or unlawful activity and, you know, calls it out, right? This is an intelligence report. There was no waste, fraud, you know, or unlawful activity. It was just an internal document that she decided on her own to release, right?
Right.
But then they also share, you know, a great New York Magazine profile about her that goes into her whole story, her life, her upbringing, and her motivations for doing what she did. So I guess, you know, the conversation is sort of happening there, but I wish there was just a little bit more of that in the play, but maybe that's just my own.
This is so shallow, but I just wanted her Pikachu shoes.
Sorry?
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted the Pikachu sneaker she was wearing, and that's the most shallow thing I could say about this
play. I mean,
play.
I think that my biggest takeaway of the play is just her performance is...
Oh my God!
Is unbelievable.
Yes, yes. Nominators,
she's like snotting everywhere.
Voters, remember
she's Viola Davis and just crying, snotting. Seriously. Like, oh my God!
I will take this into consideration.
That's right. We're sitting with the president of one of the organizations. So amazing, cool. So that was this is room. Perhaps we'll see it again in New York.
I've heard.
We've heard things. Things have been said.
Some peeps.
Yeah. whispers, murmurs, shouts. So I guess we'll stay tuned for that. Moving on to our third show of the episode, we're going to talk about A Soldier's Play. So this is a play that's currently a Roundabout Theater Company production at the American Airlines Theater. I should say Lucy Barton is currently playing at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater. And this room is closed, so you can't get a ticket. But A Soldier's Play takes place on an army base in central Louisiana in 1944 at the height of World War II. As a black sergeant's mysterious murder triggers an investigation by a fearless black captain who clashes with his white counterparts in a still segregated military and chases down the truth. So this is, you know, in one way of looking at it is that it's a crime procedural. It's a murder mystery.
It's a great episode of Law and Order.
Right. Exactly. It's an episode of Law and Order, right?
Minus Marushka.
Yeah.
Right.
But it also...
And she was sorely missed. I will say that much.
Yes, well, I know exactly what you're going to say.
Yeah, I know
about
you
this
know
play.
What I'm going to say too.
But I mean, you know, the thing about it though that makes it that I think keeps it from being just a straight up episode of Law and Order.
Blair Underwood's pecs.
Well, Blair Underwood's pecs for sure.
Well received.
Well received and noted. no, is the fact of its setting right of
sure.
a very specific milieu of African American soldiers. During World War II, in a segregated unit in the military, which to me just layers on an entire, you know, facet to it that makes it so endlessly interesting. And this is a play that was written in 1981, premiered at the Negro Ensemble Company, won the 1982 Pulitzer Prize for drama, mm-hmm. Was made into a 1984 film, and is just now in 2020 receiving its Broadway debut.
It's still a controversial play.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say kudos to the Pulitzer Prize board of 1982 for having the like prescience to see that this was a work that would continue speaking to generations for decades to come. It wasn't just a flash in the pan.
I mean, they've always been more progressive than the Tonys.
Well,
they awarded three women last year.
There you go. There you go. Okay, so Casey, you've already alluded to one strain of criticism
about
the play.
Okay, yes. Well, but you've just said so many true things, and I don't in any way, shape, or form want to undercut the historical significance, just the theatrical significance of everything you just said. However, any play that could exist exactly the way it does right now with those on stage and those off, if every woman on earth disappeared, I'm never going to be able to get all the way behind. And obviously, this is not about, you know, straight white men, so that's cool.
Sorry,
as the straight
white man.
I accept your apology somewhat. But I did write this on Twitter, so it's not surprising. But I just, it is a story about non-white soldiers, but there were also, you know, non-white women in war adjacent times as well. Mm-hmm. And obviously we're not going to retroactively go back and, you know, add them into this play. It was a different time, but I mean, just, it's also, there's a male director it had me thinking about how many times that's happened on Broadway where the entire cast and creative team were women. And the only thing I could think about in the last decade is Eclipsed.
Mm-hmm. Lifespan of a Fact, didn't that have an entirely female?
But there were two men in the cast.
And
it was written by three guys.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I'm just remembering
the press release. Right?
And actually, I want to clarify what I mean by, because there are female creatives on the technical side, but when I say all female principal creative team, that means writer, director, and in musicals, composer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a bummer. And then I posted this on Twitter, and then it came to my attention that there are four plays this season of which that is true.
Really?
Where there's
I saw this, and I was trying to think of them off the top of my head.
Yeah. It's A Soldier's Play. Yeah. The new the baseball revival.
Oh, Take Me Out.
Take Me Out. That Mammoth play.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly.
American Buffalo.
Spelled Groan.
You'll have to come back for that episode.
Oh, with a pleasure.
And then there's one more.
It'll come. But
I hope it doesn't. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's, I mean, completely
but
fair and
I
valid.
Just want to say it one more time.
Yeah.
Everything you said about this play is true. It's a story worth telling for sure. It's just a little bit of a bummer that it's one of four.
Right.
You know?
Right, right, right. Well, I mean, Roundabout Theater Company, to their credit, I think 3 or 4 seasons ago, there was a lot of criticism and very much deserving that they had produced yet another all-white season where every single cast was white.
Yeah, this is very unlike Roundabout.
Was white. Yeah, so I mean, I think that they're very intentionally trying to change course. And Kenny Leon has said that he's, you know, he's been working with Todd Haynes to like, you know, have a conversation and, you know, be involved in like bringing some works by artists of color and casting people of color to be on their stages, because they are one of the preeminent nonprofit theater companies in New York. They've been around for over 50 years.
Yeah, maybe the.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think they might be the oldest.
Yeah.
Other than
the public.
I will say as far as Roundabout Productions go, on that level, this one certainly didn't strike me as anything in their milieu for that reason, but also because it felt cohesive. Nothing. There are very few things that I see.
You're going to get some angry publicists in your inbox.
You know.
So be it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a critic.
Right. You are?
True.
And I've been, you know, I grew up in New York. I've been seeing Roundabout Theater Company shows since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a while back in the early to mid 2000s, it often felt like they would have 3 dartboards: the dartboard with the play, a dartboard with this Q-list celebrity that they can cast in it, and the dartboard with that I'm going to get in trouble for this. But in the past couple of years, they've been, and to some degree, the Rose Tattoo sort of feels that way.
Mm. Yeah,
which we're immediately
talking about incohesive, right? And that production was all over the place.
That was terrible.
It was awful. Yeah.
It was so bad. No one knew what play they were in, least of all poor Marissa Tomei.
Let it be known that I'm not saying any of this.
Yeah.
But A Soldier's Play had a cohesive idea.
Mm-hmm.
It all felt like they were in the same play.
True.
Yes.
And it was one that it had me from the start. It could be my love of procedurals, because it is at heart a procedural. It is a lawyer coming in and interrogating people until he finds out, and ruling out suspects until he finds out the story.
I don't know about you guys, but simple.
I did not know how it was going to end.
No.
Like I was completely on the edge of my seat until the end of the show, and totally wrapped up in the mystery of the story. Although I read afterwards that it's
Billy Budd.
It's Billy Budd, which I, you know, of course I should have seen that coming, right? And then I would have known, you know, sort of what the.
I'm glad I didn't know though. I mean, fun.
Me too.
And I had fun.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone's gonna think I shit all over the show. I did not mean to at all. I had a fun time.
Yeah.
And it's love the ending that I don't want to give away.
Yes. It's a fun watch, and that's the thing. It's the sort of play where you go and you want a bucket of popcorn because it's like, oh, this is like really
good. But also, please don't do that.
Right, no. I don't advocate that at all. But it's like it's like good, fun, like melodrama.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's really fair to say. And those actors are great.
You took the words out of my mouth.
Uniformly great.
What a terrific ensemble. Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned earlier his pecs, but the rest of him, Blair Underwood, is doing phenomenal work, as is David Alan Greer.
David Alan Greer.
Who was a replacement in the original production of the show and was in the film.
And is now
the lead in this play. I hope he gets nominated.
I don't actually think he's gotten a fair shake by a lot of the critics who don't think he's as menacing. Because he's playing an African-American sergeant, lieutenant, captain, sergeant?
He is a sergeant.
Sergeant. And his character is an unrepentant racist.
Right.
And, I mean, just in terms of what this play does, you rarely see any sort of material in the entertainment industry where you have a black character that is racist to other black characters.
Right.
And again, speaking of how just ahead of its time this play was, I mean, this was forever ago.
Yeah.
40 years? Yeah, 40 years ago.
And a lot of the critics have said that they didn't think David Alan Greer was menacing enough, or maybe they
read that.
Or maybe they were looking at it through the lens of his, you know, his comedy work.
Right.
But I feel
that's
like
their hang up.
Right.
You know?
That exactly. Leave what this is all about. I mean, this is obviously part of a much broader conversation, but everything that we bring with us into the theater is so informs our reviews, for example. I mean, just in our heads or...
I just pointed out, it's just a room, right? The fact that I'd worked at the State Department for 4 years totally informed the way I witnessed that story.
Also,
I went to see... Speaking of David Alan Grey, I went to see Porgy and Bess at the Met the other night. And the only thing, I couldn't get Audra McDonald and Norm Lewis out of my head as I was watching Porgy and Bess hang-ups.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. I thought David Alan Grier was great.
Well,
I thought Blair was great.
all of those actors who played the members of the platoon.
Wait, I mean, I just learned that one of those actors used to be a famous professional athlete.
Namdi.
Yes.
He's married to Kerry Washington.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh,
that's how I think of him.
Kerry
Washington's husband. Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to.
How cool, though.
While with a public platform, I just want to give a shout out to a guy in the ensemble named J. Alphonse Nicholson, who played a soldier who was driven into madness by the taunts of David Alan Grier's character. And I thought that guy was phenomenal. I've seen him before, but I thought he was phenomenal.
They were all really
good.
There was so much truth and humanity on that stage. And it's a testament to the writing, of course. I mean, Charles Fuller, the playwright, who's still alive.
He and Doug Turner were the original director from Negro Ensemble Company, where they were on opening night.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it's so incredibly written, giving such rich material for these actors to play. Not a single one of those characters was stock.
Right.
And then the skill that they brought to their performances and the singularity of the vision of the piece.
And they every actor in the play, you know, some of those actors have three lines. You know, Jared Grimes, who's this great tap dancer, is in it. He was in After Midnight. He was in the Radio City musical Spring Spectacular several years ago. He's this great tap dancer, and he's given like tap moments in this. But every role is just so well tailored by Kenny Leon to the distinct personalities of each actor in it, which for a large scale ensemble piece, you never really see anymore.
True.
Yeah.
There are not that many directors that can manage to do that with such finesse.
And honestly, what a perfect tie-in to the first show we talked about, which was lacking that entirely.
Yes.
And that piece had a brilliant actor to work with, and it just didn't take advantage of it at all. I think this play does the exact opposite of that and really sort of recognizes and distills every person's talent and makes just a really strong, cohesive end product.
Yeah. It's a perfect example of where the sum is greater than the total is greater than the sum of its parts.
We're not mathematicians.
Whatever that saying is.
I went into theater for a reason.
Yeah, that's how my brain don't work.
Yeah, but kudos to Roundabout. I mean, I was very impressed with this. To me, this is one of the best Roundabout productions I've ever seen in a lifetime of theater going.
And so it doesn't sound like I'm completely shitting on Roundabout. I value Roundabout. I do like Roundabout a lot, specifically the off-Broadway stuff, which always
is... I was just going to say, they're underground.
The underground stuff is great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've championed a lot of great playwrights who've gone on to do really cool stuff.
Yeah.
100%. 100%.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Roundabout. I don't hate you.
You know what?
No, but I mean, it's an open secret in New York, right? People criticize. And there is an inherent tension on all these nonprofit companies, right?
100%.
And Manhattan Theater Club gets its share of criticism too for exactly the same thing, which is they have to
fill to get celebrities.
The theaters, right? They have to get they exist purely on the money that they can raise from people buying tickets and from their generous donors,
and they have
right?
to make their subscriber base.
Correct. So there's that tension,
well.
Right?
Yeah.
And you know,
well, and that's fascinating. I mean, that's a larger conversation, but I did a thing not to go full Casey Mink, but I did a thing with Carrie Coon. I did a feature with Carrie Coon the other day because she's doing the Trace of Let's Play Bug at Steppenwolf. And it was really interesting to hear her talk about how when they were starting production of the play, they were going through any celebrity name they can think of that has theater chops that would be willing to commit to doing the play in July, and then they couldn't find one, so she was just like, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, she's a bit of a celebrity herself.
She doesn't think so.
I mean, like 200 of us watch The Leftovers, so they're not going to fill a Broadway theater. But
that's her point. But I still disagree.
She's one of the greatest living actors.
I'm still thinking of her performance in that play. I'm forgetting the title of that was at New York Theater Workshop.
Mary Jane.
Oh my God! I'm so glad that I got to touch on Carrie Coon this week.
Yeah,
I did that specifically for you.
Thank you so much.
Would you like to say anything about Katrina Lenk while we have?
Well, while we're here,
I'm just getting all your themes, Casey.
I mean, they're in rehearsals for Company right now.
There you go. Okay,
those Company photos are really hot. The marketing photos.
I am really wearing hoop earrings, and Katrina Lenk wears hoop earrings in the Company promotional.
There you go. All right, so it's all coming together.
Full circle. There Constitution, Katrina Lang, Carrie Coon, we're done. Oh, and Amy Adams. Okay, bye.
Helen Hunt for me.
Okay.
And my wife.
All right, there you go.
And specifically my wife.
We've gone off the rails. Okay.
Edit this out.
That, I think, concludes our conversation for this week. of these three shows. Before we wrap up, I was wondering if both of you could share with folks listening to this where they can find you and your work online. Casey, we'll start with you.
Oh, God. As everyone knows, I'm just on Twitter all the time.
Me too.
Extremely online, I believe.
I'm very online. I gotta get the hell off it. Anyways, please follow me. At Casey_Mink, and you can, I tweet most of my stories that I feel like you should read, but you can find all my work at backstage.com and in the old magazine.
Fabulous.
Still in print.
Excellent. David?
You can find me at theatermania.com, theater spelled with an E-R, not an R-E. I also spend way too much time on Twitter and Instagram and any sort of social network I can think of, but not TikTok. Mr. David Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N.
Perfect. Awesome. And I have to put in a little plug for Off-Broadway Week, which runs from February 10th to 23rd. Yes, that's technically 2 weeks, but we can't quibble too much. During this time, you can get 2-for-1 tickets for 33 participating shows. You should check it out. Support Off-Broadway Theater. We love Off-Broadway Theater. You can go to nycgo.com/Off-Broadway Week for more information. There's a dash between all this. So I'll say nycgo.com/Off-Broadway Week. And that's Off-Broadway Week. And that's Stage Left for this week. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back for the Tonys.
Just across the road, just behind the wall, just around the corner, a new bit of history there, right? Something you all might underestimate.
That's it for this week. Stage Left, the podcast, is a co-production of The Fabulous Invalid LLC and O&M Etc., and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was edited and engineered by Jamie Dumont and Charles Van Kirk. And special thanks to Jason Robert Brown for our theme song, Wait Till You See What's Next, from his spectacular album, How We React and How We Recover. You can find this podcast online at stageleft.nyc, on the Broadway Podcast Network website, on iTunes, and wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can read my archive of reviews at stageleft.nyc and find me on Twitter at stageleft_NYC. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Wait till you see what's next.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.